Hello, this time on Sit Rep, as Russian troops battle to secure their most significant gain in Ukraine in over a year, we look at how they're drawing on deception tactics from the Second World War. Also, the world's largest warship arrives in the Caribbean as the US continues to strike suspected drugs trafficking boats in the region. So have concerns over the legality of that action led Britain to stop some intelligence sharing with its US ally? And the Army's first new armoured fighting vehicle in 30 years. What will the deployment of Ajax mean for today's battlefield?
Why will you put the Gerald Ford strike carrier group? Why will you move it from the Mediterranean if they're only going to be striking small boats?
The Trump administration is trying to scare the military into defecting and moving Maduro and his top ministers to pave the way potentially for a transition.
Defense explained.
We can deploy 50 Ajax with full crews that are trained to operate this vehicle to the maximum of its capabilities. So as time goes by, that deployable force will increase more and more.
This is SITREP with Kate Chabot and Professor Michael Clark.
So we start in Ukraine, where the Russians are close to their most significant battlefield gain in over a year. Russian troops have been trying to take the city of Pokrovsk in Donetsk for about 18 months now and have committed tens of thousands of troops to what was once an important logistics hub for Ukraine. In a moment, we'll look at how the Russians have drawn on Nazi-style deception tactics to infiltrate the city. But first, Mike, how close are the Russians to capturing Pokrovsk and why do they want it so badly?
Well, as we speak, Kate, they are fighting in the southern suburbs of the urban centre. They've certainly got about 30 or 40% of the south. The Ukrainians, as of last night, were holding on to some of the northern suburbs, and they're still contesting some of the buildings or what's left of the buildings in the centre of Pokrovsk. But the Ukrainians look as if they're going to have to withdraw. They've got an avenue of withdrawal that's about 3 kilometres wide out to the north, but last week it was about 5 kilometres wide. So the question is, if withdrawal is inevitable, should they have started it earlier? Because they made a mess of withdrawing from Avdiivka and before that from Bakhmut, and there's a lot of argument in Kiev, as I understand it, about whether Sersky, the Ukrainian commander, has kept them there too long for political reasons, and that withdrawing might turn out to be more difficult than it should be. But as I speak now, it looks as if Ukrainian withdrawal from Pokrovsk is probably now inevitable.
Well, Forces News Ukraine reporter Simon Newton is also here. Hi, Simon. I know you've got some interesting thoughts and questions for Mike on the withdrawal, potential withdrawal.
Yes, I was just conscious of Mike's expertise, just and he mentioned it really, what lessons they will have learned from Avdiivka about a timely withdrawal and where perhaps they're going to pull back to, because we hear a lot about this fortress belt, which is slightly to the north, isn't it, I think, of Pokrovsk, but it looks as if this is part of a wider pincer movement taking place by the Russians.
I mean,
yeah?
if they withdraw, they can still defend Dobropilia, which is to the northwest. I mean, the Russians have tried twice to get into Dobropilia and been repulsed both times. So they can certainly hold that for a while. And then they'll be concerned with Kostyantynivka, because if the Russians want to build on a success in Pokrovsk, then they'll want to try to get in behind this fortress city belt that we've spoken about. They might also choose to go towards Pavlograd, which is more to the northwest than the northeast, because that would be a gateway into Dnipropetrovsk, which is a completely different region, different oblast that the Russians have never said that they wanted to conquer, but they now look as if they would like to if they could. But I would stress that they won't do any of this quickly. I mean, if the Russians do finally take Pokrovsk in the next few days, almost certainly they'll sit on it for a while, because they're never able to follow up these victories with a sort of rolling offensive. And so it would be some time before they build up forces and either go northeast or northwest. But those are the two lines that the Ukrainians will then be concerned to try to dig in at to prevent the further movement to either take the rest of the Donbass, probably sometime next year on present trends, or to move into Dnipropetrovsk and open up a completely new front in the war from the Russian point of view.
Simon, I know you've been writing some of this up for the website, but you've also been looking at how Russian troops have been slipping into the city of Pokrovsk using perfidy. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, I have to say, I confess this isn't a phrase I was very, very familiar with. So they have reportedly, and I stress reportedly, been, this is Pokrovsk and Kupiansk, as you say. So these are cities that are about 130 miles apart, both of which are kind of under siege now. Kupiansk they seized in 2022 and then lost, and now they're trying to get it back again. So we understand that Russian Spetsnaz, which are effectively special forces, have been put into Pokrovsk in very small groups, two or three men at a time, to get behind their logistic chains, to disrupt them, to hunt down the drone teams that are causing these losses, these huge losses for the Russian army. So there's nothing new about special forces doing that, of course, but the interesting thing is they are reportedly dressed in civilian clothes while they're doing this, and that's allowing them to get close to these Ukrainian units and then ambush them. And this goes against the whole kind of honor of war that we've heard about, obviously, for decades. So, and this is considered, as you say, something called perfidy, which is a crime under both the law of armed conflict and international and by the International Criminal Court. And it essentially comes down to one person gaining the confidence of another under false pretenses and then betraying that confidence.
And that must be having quite an effect on the Ukrainians trying to defend the city and the civilians inside.
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine it's horrendous for the Ukrainian soldiers. And as you say, there are some civilians still inside, because very few, but it will completely blur the line. It does completely blur the line between combatants and non-combatants. And that obviously would lead potentially to civilians being killed. And if you think about the troops on the ground are fighting this really dirty, this bitter battle. They're vastly outnumbered, about 10 to 1 by the Russians. The sky saturated with drones. I've seen some imagery where you've got like five drones in the sky at once over certain areas. That's making it practically impossible to move around. The Russians are coming at them from all sides, and now they don't know whether they're fighting a Russian soldier or a civilian. So horrendous for them.
And Mike, I said earlier the Russians were drawing on tactics employed by the Nazis in the Second World War. What did they do?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this was the Ardennes Offensive at Christmas 1944, the Battle of the Bulge, as it's popularly known. And this was the last throw on the Western Front, really, for the Nazis. They put all of their useful armoured forces together, and then they attacked through the Ardennes Forest in bad weather when the Allies were getting ready for Christmas, and everyone thought the war would be over pretty quickly. So they hit units that were not prepared for it, and they infiltrated using Allied uniforms and dressed as civilians. So they created infiltration first, and then hit a strong armoured punch westwards when the weather was bad. And for a while, of course, they achieved their objective of splitting Allied forces north and south. So the Americans found that they literally had one force in the north and one force in the south, and the Germans threw in the middle of them. It was a key moment. It would never have made a big strategic difference, but it was a salient that the Germans had created, which had to be dealt with. And of course, it was dealt with famously at Bastogne, where the famous 101st Screaming Eagles held on at Bastogne, the battered bastards of Bastogne, as they called themselves, and they held on long enough for the Allies to snuff out the salient. But the whole thing was based on deception, bad weather, and surprise. And in this case, there's no surprise about it in Pokrovsk, but there's certainly deception and there's certainly bad weather, because as we get into autumn, it's very foggy. And the Ukrainians, in this case, find that the bad weather doesn't help them, because it helps the infiltrators, which is what the Russians have been doing.
And Simon, as I understand it, the illegal part of it is not the actual infiltration by disguising yourself. It's actually launching attack once you're there.
Yeah, so this falls under the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, as I understand. So there's two war crimes taking place. There's one which is treacherous killing or wounding, which is what potentially is happening in Pokrovsk. And then there's also, you can make an improper use of a flag, effectively surrendering or pretending to surrender. And so it's basically a con trick that you're putting onto your enemy to make them believe that you need protection and then attacking them. And that's the perfidious act that you're doing. So dressing in civilian clothes is one way. It might be pretending to surrender, as I say, or pretending you're injured and then attacking your captors. And this is different from the ruses of war. I've learned all about this week. the ruses of war, which are things like feigning a retreat or using decoys or sending fake signals, for instance, they are permissible. But what we're talking about here is a deliberate, cynical act of betrayal, effectively. And that would meet the threshold of a war crime.
And Mike, just finally, would the fall of Pokrovsk change the war?
Not fundamentally, no. It's not a game changer for the Russians. I mean, Pokrovsk, before the war began, was a town of about 60,000 people. And as Simon said, there's probably, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 left there who are just trying to hang on. But I mean, it's the size of, in British terms, the size of somewhere like Corby or Canterbury or Tunbridge Wells. It's not a big prize for the Russians, but it is a hub for road transport, because there aren't that many good roads in such a big country in that part of the world, and so the good roads matter if they want to use them for rapid movements in the other side of the winter. So it's a road hub and some rail as well. So it's a step on the way to conquering the rest of the Donbass, but it's also achieved great political and symbolic value, because Putin was very confident when he spoke to Trump a little while ago that Pokrovsk had already fallen. Well, it hadn't, and it may now do. But what was not true then, the Russians are desperate to make true, which is one of the reasons why the Ukrainians may be hanging on too long, because they realize its political value, because so much has been invested in it. And in a way, they're trying to impress the man in the White House as much as they are trying to hold on for their own sake.
All right, we'll leave it there for the moment. Simon, thank you very much for your time. Well, about 6,000 miles away, Washington sent its biggest naval and military deployment to the Caribbean since the Cuban Missile Crisis. The US Navy has confirmed that the world's largest warship, the USS Gerald R. Ford, and its carrier group has arrived in the region amid rising tensions between the US and Venezuela. Donald Trump says he's fighting drug trafficking, and to that end, there have been US strikes against at least 19 boats in the Caribbean and the Eastern Pacific, killing more than 76 people, but have concerns over the legality of that action caused Britain to limit some of its intelligence sharing with its ally, the US. Mike, we can discuss that later, but let's put it all into context first. Can you just talk us through what the US has sent to the region, the nuts and bolts of this military buildup?
Yes, well, it's been going on for some time now, and what they had put into the region was the assault ship, the Iwo Jima, and then three destroyers, Arleigh Burke-class destroyers, a cruiser, a submarine. The MV Ocean Trader is an interesting one. That's a civilian ship, but it's actually a mothership for special forces. It's where they launch their special operations from. And then there's a couple of troop carriers there. There are different figures for how many US troops are in the area, because some of them are land-based as well. And then they've built up, using the Roosevelt Road, Rosie Road as it's always known, in Puerto Rico. It's a US naval base. And they've built up on Rosie Roads there a force of MQ-9 Reaper drones, the F-35 aircraft. They've got the P-8 Poseidon maritime aircraft, and a lot of Marines available. And then to all of this force, the Ford, the USS Gerald R. Ford, with its carrier group, is now arriving. I'm not sure if it's exactly in position, but it is arriving. So this is a huge build-up to do something in this part of the Caribbean. And, I mean, my guess is that President Trump hasn't decided what he wants to do with it. A lot of people are giving him all sorts of different options, and we can guess as to what they might be.
Yes, and that is a question we have been asking, why the US is building up its military and what for. I spoke to Dr. Carlos Solar, a senior research fellow in Latin American security at the defense think tank RUSI.
Yeah, well, so the military buildup is quite surprising. We've never seen this kind of deployment in the Caribbean Sea. The US has been there for decades, mostly through its US Coast Guard. So this is not new territory for the US at all. And it's not new for Trump. So the first presidency of Donald Trump, 2017, 2021, he dealt with the Venezuelan issue. But then the situation was quite different. So there you have an opposition, somewhat that you could politically support from Washington to make a change in Venezuela. All right. But that opposition has mostly disappeared after the recent elections in Caracas. So now I think Trump is just going for an option that he probably saw earlier, which was, what if we military strike, or would put enough military pressure for Maduro to take some action, either to give up power, to go elsewhere, and so on. So I think this is what we're seeing now. I don't want to say that Donald Trump is a newbie on Venezuela. Not at all. I think he knows Venezuela quite well, and I think he's now surrounded by people who wants to see the U.S. agenda move forward with the Nicolas Maduro regime.
And what is the U.S. agenda with Venezuela?
That's a great question, and I think it has every single analyst outside of Washington questioning what's Donald Trump's end goal with this. I mean, the U.S. Coast Guard had quite a successful interdiction of the drug trafficking. So now with the, with stopping the boats and so on, I don't think it will deter the drug trafficking stemming out of Venezuela north into Florida. So the big question is, how long can Donald Trump put pressure on Maduro? How long will he keep the largest carrier strike group that the U.S. Navy has? And with what purpose? So just for the purpose of drug trafficking seems a little bit too much, hitting a fly with a massive hammer. So regime change has been in question. It's hard to produce regime change in Venezuela and ensure that something pacific, a new democracy, will flourish from one day to the next. There are so many questions about where would you put Maduro if he hands power, if there is a strike from the U.S., military capabilities of Venezuela will be a hit, and so on. I think there are a lot of questions, and we don't have a clear understanding from the U.S. Southcom, from the Department of War, on where Donald Trump wants to take this next.
What do you think the potential is, though, for armed conflict between the U.S. and Venezuela? Or do you think this is a political stunt, albeit a very expensive one?
Oh, no, well, I think that's the core of the argument that many will do and say, why will you put the Gerald Ford strike carrier group? Why will you move it from the Mediterranean if they're only going to be striking small boats? It makes absolute no sense in terms of military capability, military tactics, and so on. I think something could happen if the Venezuelans feel too much pressure. I don't think the Venezuelans will strike any of the U.S. Capabilities that are down there. But you never know when you have so much power, so close to the exclusive economic zone of Venezuela. We've seen the B-52s, we've seen the F-35s flying very, very near to Venezuela. Mm. So if something goes wrong, it might spark some sort of conflict. Now, just by looking at the U.S. capability, I mean, they have the upper hand, they have the best deal. So even if they strike first and they get a reaction from Venezuela, this is all science fiction at the moment. But then what the U.S. can do to Venezuela is just so unimaginable. We've never seen it in the region. The Western Hemisphere has been quite peaceful in terms of interstate war over the last 100 years or so. We have organized crime, which is a big thing, and is the largest security threat and risk in the region. But war, it wasn't in the recent history of Latin America.
And what about the Venezuelan response to the American military buildup? How has it responded in country and nearby?
Well, the Venezuelans have moved all their coastal defenses. The population is quite on the move towards a potential attack. You can hear from the rhetoric used by Nicolas Maduro that he's rallying people behind him. But remember that this is also an authoritarian regime under pressure. So Nicolas Maduro has always tried and kept the Venezuelan people supporting the regime. And now if the regime is being attacked from abroad, he has more reason to compel the population to back him up. It's difficult for the daily lives of Venezuelans, mostly because there's no opposition to Nicolas Maduro. So there's no way to politically confront Nicolas Maduro or to politically talk to the U.S. I don't think that Donald Trump will want to engage in diplomacy with Nicolas Maduro at this point, mostly because he tried already. And he always blames that the Democrats and the Joe Biden administration didn't deal with Maduro in the right way. So now we've ended up at this point with a military buildup.
And how likely is it that other actors will be drawn into this? Russia, for example, would want to prevent potentially devastating effects of its economy to its economy of the opening up of Venezuela's vast oil reserves.
Absolutely. You have so many actors in and around of Venezuela. You have Russia, Iran, China, and other actors that have always bought the oil from Venezuela. The state of the economy of Venezuela is in a downward spiral. They're not selling and they're not getting any of the oil that they have at this position. So whoever can buy the oil from them, they're happy to exchange that for military expertise, for military technologies, from software packages, for cybersecurity, things in which Russia is quite good at. So if you think about hybrid conflict or hybrid guerrilla, which has been mastered by Moscow lately, the Venezuelans are keen to learn, and they've always learned from the Cubans, the Venezuelan, the Russians, Iranians, and so on. So it's not just a U.S.-Venezuela kind of thing. It has some broad implications on geopolitics in the region.
And you point towards a critical moment when Donald Trump must decide whether to renew this military operation or not. When is that?
So I think the first 2 months have already passed. And I think that earlier in November, earlier in this month, I think he might have renewed for another 2 months. So everyone was looking at what was going to happen when the first calendar of these 2 months will end, and nothing changed. Now we have the Gerald Ford in the water. So actually, it wasn't like Trump was going to come back from it. They have doubled down their military size and power in the region.
Carlos Sola, great to speak to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kate.
Mike, just to return to something I mentioned earlier, we tried to get clarity on reports that the UK has stopped some intelligence sharing with the US because of the drug boat strikes, as first reported by CNN. We've not had a response from the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. Whatever the truth is, are concerns over extrajudicial killings warranted?
Yes, they certainly can be, and they've happened before. I mean, we've had, we the British have had concerns over extraordinary rendition during the big days of the war on terror, so-called, by the Bush administration, because there's dubious legality in that. Over Guantanamo Bay, again, very dubious legality of Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. And over some of the black operations in Afghanistan. And usually, I mean, what the British are motivated by is the idea that if these things are judged illegal in international law at some time in the future, then British forces and individuals in Britain might be regarded as complicit. And so generally speaking, when these concerns are raised, we try to obtain assurances from the United States that things are being done in a legal way. And we don't know what those assurances are. But it's not abnormal for Britain to worry about this. And indeed, in other cases, to be a bit restrictive in terms of intelligence sharing. Now, whether this report is true, it was reported in CNN that Britain has withdrawn a certain amount of intelligence sharing. And if that is the case, the Americans will be very angry about that, because British intelligence in the Caribbean is pretty good. Because of our own natural links in the Caribbean, we do have quite a lot of intelligence over narcotics. So if that has been suspended, that's relatively serious. But it comes back to the old idea that all intelligence sharing is based on trust. Mm. And if the feeling is that the United States at the moment either cannot be trusted with our intelligence, because Trump has played fast and loose with the foreign intelligence in the past, or our intelligence is being abused for some purpose that may turn out to be judged unlawful, and literally the attacking 19 boats and killing 76 people in an extrajudicial way simply because they are now said to be terrorists without any production of any evidence whatsoever, that seems pretty that seems fairly questionable. And so I think that the damage to the intelligence relationship, if that's what it is probably at this stage inevitable.
Mike, just I noticed during that last interview you smiling when I asked the question about the US agenda on Venezuela. I wonder if you can enlighten us on that at all, but also what their interest would be if there were a change of regime.
Oh, they certainly like a change of regime for all sorts of political reasons. They would like better relations with a new Venezuela if they could. And what I think is likely to happen is my guess is that the United States forces, they won't try and invade Venezuela because they don't actually have enough to do that cleanly and without any casualties, which is what they would want. But they certainly have plenty of force to go after what they would take to be narcotics hubs. So they might actually start attacking what they say are the narcotics hubs in Venezuela. But I mean, one thing that this is not really about is narcotics traveling by sea, because 80% of all of the Latin American narcotics that come into the United States come in through the land border with Mexico.
Yes.
They come in through the customs posts. And the 20% that come by sea, almost all of that 20% come on the Pacific side from Colombia, from Peru and Ecuador. Very, very few come by sea from Venezuela. So attacking boats out of Venezuela has got nothing much to do with narcotics. It's all to do, I think, with establishing a kind of a deterrence to all narcotics traders in the region, whether they're governmental or not, to say, don't send your narcotics to the United States.
Yes.
Do something else with them. And I think that's probably the message. And I think that message will be backed up by some military strikes. And if it brings down the Venezuelan government at the same time, all the better. If it doesn't, Trump will certainly claim that they've established a sort of a ring of iron to prevent narcotics coming into the United States. They won't have, but that's what he will say.
I'm sure this story is going to need an update fairly soon. Thanks, Mike. Now, the long-awaited Ajax armoured fighting vehicle has just reached a milestone. It has finally attained initial operating capability, meaning it will face its next test, being deployed on operations. Forces News reporter Sophie Kakayonas was invited for a ride and has been telling me about the considerable challenges the project has faced.
It's been a bumpy road for Ajax, to say the least. So originally the programme was supposed to be ready in 2017, so it's 8 years late, which probably isn't a surprise to your listeners. And there have been widely publicised issues. So over 300 people were exposed to excessive noise and vibrations from Ajax vehicles, meaning the programme took a pause in 2020 and 2021, four of whom were then medically discharged, some of them for reasons related to hearing loss. But we're now told those issues have been resolved through vigorous testing.
So tell us a bit more about Ajax and what it brings to the British Army.
You'll hear people refer to their Ajax family or programme. So overall, the programme vehicle cost is around £5.5 billion. So it works out about £10 million per vehicle. And there are six variants. When completed, we'll have 589 vehicles. And the Ajax itself is one of these six variants. So some of the features people are excited about that I've spoken to include a sighting system, which is independently controlled, and you get 360-degree sight with optical and thermal capability, and the suite of acoustic sensors, which means the Ajax can listen to and hunt, more importantly, targets up to 5 miles away. And all of this is part of a concept by the British Army to win by recce strike. And there's also its 40mm case telescoped cannon, which can strike targets on the move. The mechanism that feeds the ammunition into the cannon doesn't move, regardless of the elevation of the barrel, which a lot of people are excited about. And the manufacturer says it means it's going to be more stable, better at firing on the move, and more reliable overall than a conventional weapon. So from the outside, it may look like a standard armoured vehicle that we've seen on the battlefield in decades gone by, but it's the particularly well-guarded technology inside the vehicle that mainly sets it apart. As Captain George Beale, officer commanding recce, the Queen's Royal Hussars Battle Group, was telling me.
I think the catchline people have been using today is the Fiat Punto to a Tesla or something. But I think it's a pretty fair representation of the step change in the technology that is available to you as a commander. When I first stepped into the vehicle, you're surrounded by the screens and the toggle switches, whatever it is. But in the way the system's designed, it's really accessible. Our troopers, lance corporals of anything from 17, 18 up to into the early 20s, they take to using the systems really, really quickly.
So the Tesla of the British Army, Sophie, how will it actually fit in, though, to the modern day battlefield?
Well, that's the question that we all wanted to know the answer to, because this reconnaissance platform, it was designed in 2010. to have lethal effect at a greater range, but the battlefield has come a long way since then. It's saturated with drones. But in simple terms, the Ajax fits into the Army's 20-40-40 concept that we saw announced in the Strategic Defence Review in the summer. So the 20% is traditional platforms like Ajax, artillery and tanks. So having soldiers in the loop, able to hold ground on the battlefield. And these platforms are then being used alongside a 40% of disposable systems, so like one-way drones, and 40% of AI-powered assets like long-range surveillance drones, much like we're seeing in Ukraine. I asked Colonel Jamie Hayward how the Ajax will work alongside these other systems. He's the program director of the Armored Cavalry program.
It's an open architecture which allows the platform to be rapidly upgraded over time, which you'll appreciate is one of the other lessons from Ukraine about the ability to adapt. So the electronic architecture could allow us in the future to control drones. General Dynamics have already proven that in their own sort of internal testing rather than army testing, that they can use the vehicle alongside drones. And then the systems on the vehicle allow us to detect drones as well. So we've got really capable day and night sights.
So, Sophia, you got a ride in one. What was it like?
Yes, I was very lucky. And I was told beforehand it could quite possibly be the ride of my life. We went round the track at 40 kilometres an hour. So that's just over half the top speed of 70. And then we went up and over a 31 degree hill, which was really smooth, a bit like a roller coaster ride, actually. And we had to wear overhead ear protection. So that is something, especially with all the issues they've been having, that they're really hot on. And the driver thinks it's a great bit of kit too. A lot of the people that work there and are testing these vehicles are veterans themselves. And Luke Pollard, the Minister for Defence Readiness and Industry, he told me at initial operating capability, which is where we're at now, we can deploy 50 Ajax with full crews that are trained to operate this vehicle. But the real test, as always, will be on deployment, which there hasn't been any news of yet, but we'll keep you updated.
Sophie, great to hear that. Thank you very much for that. And I'm glad you enjoyed your time with Ajax. Mike, so the next stage is how it all goes on deployment. What could possibly go wrong?
Yes, quite a lot, actually, in any deployment. But I think Sophie's report was really interesting because what it emphasises, of course, is what the Army would want you to understand, is that it's not so much about the vehicle, it's not so much about the biscuit tin that is the outside, it's what is inside it that matters, and it's the systems that are inside it. But this thing will either stand or fall by the changes in armoured warfare in the new concept. So if we're talking about armoured warfare with combined forces of the tanks themselves, infantry fighting vehicles and armoured fighting vehicles working side by side, then Ajax doesn't look like the most reliable or best vehicle because of the nature of what it does. Mm. But if we're talking about a much more disaggregated battlefield where mobility and strike and reconnaissance is important, then Ajax, with its speeds and its ability to move around and to have all the right sort of stuff inside the biscuit tin, might turn out to be the right vehicle.
Finally, Mike, Armistice Day won't have escaped our audience this week, with gatherings up and down the country involving service personnel, veterans and the public. I'm just wondering, Mike, at that 2-minute silence, are there some years that are more memorable to you than others?
I remember when I was at King's College, which is on the Strand, on Remembrance Day, whatever day of the week it tended to fall, quite a lot of us actually from the college used to go out to St Clement Danes, which is the church in the Strand, Christopher Wren Church, just a couple of hundred yards up the Strand. And at St Clement's, and that's, you know, oranges and lemons, upset the bells of St Clement's, that's a St Clement's, and it's the RAF church. And we just used to stand outside the church in that period, 5 minutes before, and then the bells would go and we'd stand there for 2 minutes and just reflect in front of a couple of statues there of RAF leaders. And I remember most years you'd see black cabs would pull in at that part of the Aldwych, and they'd stop and the drivers would get out and stand there with us. And it was a group of people, very often fairly young people, And they were just remembering, just that act of remembrance I found was quite moving. And I thought, you know, this year is the 80th anniversary of the end of the Second World War. You know, we've had all of our 80 anniversaries all through the war, of the 80th of the start of the war and Battle of Britain and D-Day. And then this year, you know, we've celebrated the VE Day, Victory in Europe Day. And then on the 15th of August this year, it was VJ Day, which is the end of the Second World War. And the 80th anniversaries, I always think, are the most poignant because they're the last ones that are still within living memory. Mm-hmm. And I was speaking at a naval dinner on the 15th of August this year, which is the anniversary of VJ Day. And I said then that today, that day, felt pretty significant to me because it was that day when we marked the passing of that generation who are still with us. It was the day when we recognize that we say our final goodbyes and, you know, record again our profound thanks. And it seems very poignant when we move on from these 80th anniversaries. But if we've still got remembrance, then in fact we've still got a way of expressing our gratitude even when the individuals have passed on. And for that reason, the number of young people, I think, that I see at standing around at remembrance moments, I think is very important to our society.
Indeed. Thanks for those thoughts, Mike. Professor Michael Clark and I will be back with another SITREP next Thursday. You can stay up to date with all the latest defence news on our website, forcesnews.com. But to that point that Mike was just making, we're going to leave you with some words from the Prince of Wales as he addressed a virtual assembly of school children this week to impress on them the importance of remembrance. Bye-bye.
Coming together for remembrance is a vital way to honour those whose service keeps us safe. Even today, as we continue to face a number of conflicts across the world, we honour those who have gone before us and those who are serving now. Their memories matter. Their lives matter. And they remind us to be respectful, kind, brave, and thoughtful every day. I hope that you can find your own connection to remembrance and carry it forward so we never forget.